Good to see everyone. I haven't been in much in touch with the Mike community for some time, and it's fun to come back and see a lot of old friends. This is going to be a big change from what we've been listening to so far. Not only am I talking about an ephemeral system, but we're talking no trees and almost no soil. So be kind of a different approach. I'm going to try to be summing up some work that my colleague Ursula Shepherd and I have been doing for the last 8 years or so. We also have been working with three students, and we'll try to get their projects in as well. In one way or another, we're all at the University of New Mexico, either part of the museum or the Department of Biology or the University Honors Program there. So our outline for this is really pretty simple. How did we get into this? Which is a question we got fairly often. What did we get out of this? And then what's next? So how did we get into this? Ursula and I are primarily ecologists and biogeography people and interested in changes in climate and land use. Where we are in the southwestern U.S. and, well, actually any place that biological crusts exist, this sort of destruction is pretty common. They're easily trampled and damaged. In New Mexico, we're having particular problems with ATVs and other off-road vehicles damaging them. So part of what we wanted to do was look at conservations of habitat type and in conjunction with biodiversity studies. So for those of you who live in places that actually have ground cover, I thought I might explain what the soil crusts are. They are an association between soil particles and a number of taxa, very broadly distributed group of cyanobacteria, algae, fungi, lichens, and mosses. They're very shallow. They're only a few millimeters deep. This cube drawing shows you how rich they are, but remember, it's on a very small scale. The importance of crusts in arid systems are to increase soil stability. They add some nitrogen content. They help water infiltrate into the soil instead of running off the surface. They have low water requirements, which is good, and low light requirements, which is not a problem in the open areas where they occur. They do occur in about a third of Earth's habitats that have a lot of open area, and that would include deserts, coasts, polar regions, a lot of grasslands, and in open areas and forests as well. A disadvantage is that they are ephemeral, is that they don't work all the time. They're photosynthetic sometimes, and other times they are not. And while I've listed it as a disadvantage here, we'll see that if Ursula and I can convince you that we try to turn it around to an advantage for us. So our first questions were there any microarthropods in biotic crusts, which may sound like a trivial question, but at the time we started this, we really had no idea quite what to expect. Should we find any, we wanted to know if we had the usual sorts of community composition and if there were preferences associated with different types of crusts or life forms, those that were predominantly mossy in structure versus lichenous, or a combination of the two, and also if we saw any seasonal differences. Our sites are in central New Mexico in pinyon juniper habitat, and we began in 99 and 2000 with this. We were removing only small amounts of crusts because, remember, part of this was conservation of this kind of habitat, and so we didn't want to have to like destroy whole areas in order to save them, as the saying goes. So we were taking small amounts, but had good replication, and we used a heptane flotation to extract mites and collembolins. This map of New Mexico gives you some idea of the elevation variety that we have in the state, and also some of the large ecoregions that influence the fauna and the plants, too, of New Mexico. Our study sites are about where the, about where the bee is in Albuquerque. So we were up in the Sandia Mountains, not too far from where we live. And these are the views of two of the sites that we had. They were in different drainages, mostly in dry arroyos. And so the junipers are the tallest vegetation that you see out there. They're subtrees or tall shrubs. So if you're looking down at the ground, we put this ruler here for a comparison for you. This is what a typical patch of this biotic crust would look like. If you get closer to it, you can see that it's just a very thin, kind of spongy layer that isn't very big. But if you get really close to it and you look at that moss in detail, it does look like a sort of miniature forest, and there seems to be, there's quite a lot of structure that we thought that microarthropods might be able to take advantage of. This is a view of crusts that are primarily of lichen, and they're often black in appearance, even though if you were to break open the crust, you could see that there's a green algal layer just underneath the surface that is photosynthesizing. And again, we thought that these areas of high sugars and chlorophyll and water would be of interest to microarthropods, considering that they're in areas that are otherwise pretty dry. So for starters, then, what did we get out of this? We were pleasantly surprised to collect a whole suite of species covering a number of trophic groups in all of these kinds of crusts. So the very high overlap actually among the different types of crust, meaning that the overall number of species was not very high. And so for all of you who've been talking about hundreds of species and estimating even thousands of species, I'm going to tell you that we really have about 30 taxa, which we were happy with that. And we also found other members of the community, both larger and smaller, suggesting to us anyway that the crust use was not accidental. So some of the smaller members of the community that we found included tardigrades and nematodes, which we couldn't do much with an identification, and also larger members such as pseudoscorpions and the occasional diploran, which was a real surprise to us. I was not expecting that in such an arid habitat. So this is a short list, a partial list of some of the taxa that we found. Quite a different set from other genera that we've been hearing about this afternoon. In fact, the Eupodes, now that I see Cal here, I sent that to Cal and I said, how do you like my Raphognathid? And he said, your Eupodid is very fine. So I can thank everyone for helping with IDs early on here. This is from one of the papers that Ursula and I did, and there are, I'll show you two, another slide like this, talking about the four dominant genera that we had, two of which were mites and two of which were columbellans. Within the Nanarchestids, this, what is probably an undescribed Neo-Nanarchestes, was far and away our most abundant species, and it was strongly associated with early season, or a late winter. We got most of them in March, and they were also strongly associated with mossy crusts, and that they were far pickier about it than many others. One of the Orobatids, however, had kind of the opposite lifestyle. It was kind of everywhere all the time, except at rather low numbers. So the taxa that are out there are certainly not all doing the same thing. And here's a collage of the sorts of things that we found. The Neo-Nanarchestid is in the upper left on the black background. Certainly Delids were common. We had the occasional Golumnid, and we had Tydeids. With regard to the springtails, we had Cryptopagus ambus, which is the most common isotomid, and it was less picky about being on mossy crust, also liked lichen-based crusts as well, but again, strongly preferred, most active in the winter months. The same for Tilburgia, which is an onychurid, a blind, small, soil-dwelling columbellan. And there's a picture of Cryptobagus, and once in a while we would even get a Sminthurid, which was always appealing. So that left off in 2000. Jessica Martin and Stephanie Moquin repeated our sampling in 2007, and we were expecting higher richness and abundance this time, because when Ursula and I began this study, it was during a drought year. And so again, people were saying, why are you doing this? You know, your system isn't even functioning hardly. And so up here I have for a comparison to show you that during that winter season, a La Nina or dry season for us, we had 48 millimeters of precip compared to 104 over the same period in from 2006 to 2007, which was an El Nino year, and which means a wet non-monsoon season for us. So we thought the whole area would green up and that we would see, you know, mites would come thundering in, and it was not true. So what we're showing here is that although the sites overall had more precipitation for longer periods, the total number of species that were collected, at least for the mites and the other arthropods, the others being things like pseudoscorpions and the campodid or the gepigid diplurans, those numbers went down. We've used the hill numbers here with NO to show the total species richness, which declined. However, N1, which is the number of abundant species, that went up. And N2, which is the number of very abundant species, also went up. And actually what that also means is that the number of that Neonanorchestes went down. And it kind of gave the others a chance to make up more of the proportion of the total catch. On the Shannon-Wiener diversity index, the diversity overall went up. But on that bottom row, you can see that while we collected 1,400 individuals in that 2000 study, there were only 450 in 2007. So, and there was no change in the dominance, and the four groups that we just looked at graphs of continued to be the four main groups. What changed were abundances rather than rank order of dominance. So one conclusion that we came to here was that trying to work on an ephemeral system, which the crusts are, they only photosynthesize when they're wet. During dry periods, they dry up and wait for more water to come, and they wait for things to cool down. So working on an ephemeral system in a habitat that is already variable, which arid systems are, really requires perseverance and long-term study when we've not had the resources to quite do that yet. So we're kind of chipping away at it as we can. Even with that increased rain and snow in 2007, there were more crust patches active probably, and in that case the microarthropods were perhaps more spread out, and so our sampling didn't, we didn't actually include in the sample quite the proportion that we did in the dry year. And it may also be that the increased soil moisture kept microarthropods below ground. If the soil moisture was high, there was no need to seek out these little crust patches that were green and photosynthesizing. But Ursula and I said, well, can't we use the crust system as a model in looking at studying patch dynamics? And especially since the mossy crusts here are pretty well delineated, and they make a sort of nice island in this otherwise, you know, pretty much mineral soil, with a really low organic matter content. And we had another student, Christy Tarleton, take some of the data that we collected at the same time that we were working on the abundance and richness data, and try to apply predictions from the theory of island biogeography to that. And so we had set up, when we did the collecting, we had measured the patch size and how far it was to the next patch and how big it was, and we wanted to see if we could have things work with the island biogeography theory, because this would be a really wonderful small-scale system in which to look at patch dynamics. Christy found an effective area, which is something that we've all been talking about today, is that the bigger the area, or the more often that you sample it, the more things you find. But we did not find any effect of distance between patches. And so we found that the crusts don't really act as a good island in that sense, although they certainly look like it from the surface when you're out walking around. While it's possible that the microarthropods may not be crossing the open areas between these patches, they certainly can move underground. But that still didn't keep us down. And by working on crusts and their associated microarthropods, that we made us think about islands and patches in general and how or even if ephemeral systems fit into these categories, and how it is important as a researcher to consider the point of view of your target organism when you're deciding on whether it's living on an island or a fragment or some other kind of patch. Just because it looks like an island to you doesn't necessarily mean it looks like an island to your target. And we had read David Watson's 2002 paper in the Journal of Biogeography that set up a framework and a kind of key, in a way, for studying species composition in islands and fragments and other patchy systems, mostly as a means of conservation. What kind of trajectory are these kinds of systems on? Are they inclined? Are they growing? Are they declining? And Dave Watson specifically said in his paper that he did not include ephemeral systems in this. And after Ursula and I had gone through all of this work with the crusts and had talked about islands and patches, we understood why, because they're pretty hard to fit into this. And we ended up writing a paper that expanded on that, classifying patches when those areas are also ephemeral. So for us, what's next at the local level, because we haven't been able to continue collecting on a regular basis, some basic alpha taxonomy was not a bad idea for us. We've collected on the crusts. We have not done traditional soil sampling because we wanted to know what was happening at the crust level and not below it or around it. So that would be our next level, our next place to go in collecting. On a regional level, in another paper, we had looked at, we compared our species with other studies that had been done in the region, in grasslands, certainly with Walt Whitford's work in the southern part of New Mexico. And we found extremely low overlap. So the overall diversity in the southwestern region, as it is everywhere, of course, is much higher and really poorly known. So at this point, any collecting that I do for any project that I work on, if I get mites and other small, you know, meso microarthropods in as bycatch, I'm keeping those for the museum so that we will eventually get a picture of what's out there. And then at a system level, we do still feel like crusts and microarthropods are a good example of an ephemeral system, especially because of the overall low species richness. But we still have a pretty complete community. We have all the trophic levels. Crusts are certainly common in very many places. There's lots of replication and comparison possible. The problem is that it's just very hard to predict when those crusts are going to be active. And we were rushing out to the field when it would snow, trying to catch things, and with mixed success. So, and keeping any lab populations too off of these was really quite difficult. Not so much so for the orobatids, but the nanarchestids, we could not keep at all well. So, if anybody has any advice on keeping small prostegs, let me know. And so I would like to acknowledge everybody from the Ohio State training that I've had and help that we've had at the University of New Mexico for lab space and good conversations about patch studies, and to thank the Forest Service for letting us collect there and UNM funding. Oh, and that's Ursula and me from, you know, actually pulling the mites off the heptane flotation. So, if you've got any questions, I'd be happy to take them. Yes, Roy.
You showed me at the end a question I was going to ask. Was all your sampling with the heptane method?
Yes.
Did you just ever try running a funnel and doing a flotation on the sample?
Oh, after the fact? Yes, we did. And that didn't turn up much more. Everything was really quite depauperate. We had lots of zeros in this sample, unfortunately.
guess my question is, did the heptane, was it really a benefit, or could you have gotten just as much?
I think so. What I think was the problem, and I sort of alluded to it earlier when I said we just took small patches of the crust because we were trying not to, you know, take whole truckloads of the stuff out. But I think overall our samples were too small, and we needed to take bigger patches to work with. So it's almost like regardless of the method, whether we did it by funnels or we did like heptane flotation, I think we didn't take enough to work with. So that's one thing that I would change as we go forward on that. Yeah, Art.
I understand what your concerns and limitations are about being this a protected area and not doing much of a sampling, but what about, for example, inducing or simulating precipitation just by irrigating salt patches?
We tried. Yeah, because we thought, aha, we will outsmart them, you know. We will go out and we will rain on them, and we'll, you know, we'll be able to have a time course, you know. Do we need to wait 24 hours, 72 hours, you know, for them to find it and for it to get into the soil column and everything? It didn't work. We had, the predictability was still awful. It really is patchy. We would essentially have to live out there, I think. You know? But yeah, we thought about that. Yeah.
So
Amanda.
Are these communities active then, regardless? It seems wet years or dry years. It seems like in a very dry year you got really good numbers. So
we did, but only in the winter.
Okay.
So it really is tightly associated with a winter season. By the time, regardless of it being an El Nino or La Nina year for us, by the time we got into some warm weather come June through August, in the August sampling, everybody had fled. You know, the crusts were dry, and there was virtually nothing to be found on them. But in the wintertime, it seemed like that was the time that the snow or the precipitation would stay long enough to green up these crusts and stay in the soil enough to where we would get some activity. And one of the things that we had hoped to show from this was that here's a system that's working in the wintertime when most everything else is not. And but even so, it's difficult to, the rain is so local in our area that it's hard to say how long a crust will even stay turned on and be photosynthesizing. It really is kind of a matter of days, and they dry back up.